The Invention of the Jewish People by Shlomo Zand. Preface to the 2020 edition, 10 years later. The Italian philosopher Benedetto Croce rightly said that every history is fundamentally a contemporary history. The present conditions every account of the past and gives it each time a particular significance. 10 years have passed since the first publication of this book, and the passage of time has left its mark. 10 years ago, many of us thought that the most persistent national myths were beginning a historical decline, one still hesitant but promising. The brilliant writings of Ernest Gellner and Benedict Anderson were influential in the Western intellectual sphere, while even in Israel, archaeological discoveries invalidating biblical legends about the Exodus from Egypt or the existence of the great kingdom of Solomon were received with a relative tolerance. A sense of doubt at the end of the century encouraged critical approaches to the past, one that without hesitation questioned the ahistorical essentialism at the heart of collective identities. The acceleration of economic globalization was most likely the background to the rise of these intellectual sensibilities. Capitalism moved its production centers and expanded the global market. In Europe, many national borders were abolished to the point of losing their absolute value, some becoming no more than brief halts for citizens on their way to work or leisure activities. The traditional protectionism of nation-states lost its usefulness. Supranational entities were strengthened while customs posts fell. At one point, it may have seemed that individual consumption would increase indefinitely and all social strata would benefit. At the same time, cultural globalization has developed. It is easy to get the impression that audiovisual media and the internet have transformed the world into a global village. News, writing, films, and TV shows are translated, broadcast, and consumed worldwide by millions of people. Everyone, by tapping on the keyboard of their smartphone, can draw information from many sources on previously inaccessible topics. The lower cost of air travel has allowed greater mobility for people to gain first-hand knowledge of distant foreign cultures. However, these processes have not reached all segments of society or all inhabitants of the globe. The migration of capital to less developed regions, in parallel with the accelerated phenomenon of automation, has weakened the working classes in traditional industries, turning some of them into a service proletariat, while others fall into unemployment without real protection. Confounding expectations, social inequalities have widened in an increasingly rich post-industrial world. The audiovisual media, far from strengthening critical faculties, which remain more effective, relatively speaking, in the sphere of reading and writing, have, on the contrary, impaired them. Public education has done little to immunize spectators against a constant flood of images. The overload of information has made it difficult to distinguish between the essential and the incidental, what is credible and what is false. Politics, which has always included a dimension of dramatization, has been transformed into a great spectacle without any critical dimension. The erratic movements of the global economy, linked to the credit crisis in the United States in 2008 and the arrival at the gates of Western cities of immigrants and refugees driven by war, famine, and Islamic terror, have brutally awakened collective fears, pseudo-eternal and pseudo-communitarian identities, as well as individual and collective egoisms, now dressed up with moral respectability. This socioeconomic and sociocultural context, as well as other factors that I cannot include in this brief preface, has directly or indirectly contributed to the resurgence at the heart of political discourse of national elements that were once thought antiquated and close to extinct. The universalist consciousness that had arisen with the process of decolonization, with the emergence of the 1968 generation, and even more so with European unity, is showing signs of regression. A national populism has emerged on both right and left, celebrating and magnifying the framework of the nation-state, seen as the ultimate remedy for all the ills of the people. However, at the time of writing, most French people have not gone in search of the ancestor of their ancestors, the Gauls. Italians do not consider themselves descendants of the Roman Empire, and Germans no longer fall in love with the Teutons or Aryans in whom, in the fairly recent past, they saw their direct forefathers. In the Western world, national entities are sufficiently obvious that nobody feels the need to mobilize a fictitious millennial imagination to establish their essential identity. In Israel, on the other hand, the evolution and status of historical memory presents itself very differently and has not changed over the last 70 years. From the beginning and up to the present day, the justification for the colonization of Palestine has been based on an imaginary that spans at least 3,000 or 4,000 years. If the religious Jew knows that the land of Israel, promised by God, will only be delivered when the Messiah comes, the Zionist, who did not believe in the existence of a higher power, needed a lot of history to justify his conquest of the land of his ancestors. That is why the Bible is taught in all schools in Israel from the age of 7 as a true historical account, and why it is stated in the Declaration of Independence that the Jewish people were uprooted from their homeland by force and underwent a long exile. I published this book 10 years ago for several reasons. First of all, as a historian, I felt compelled to search for truths about the past, however relative. To do this, I knew that I would sometimes have to think outside the box, question worn-out words used knowingly or unconsciously to cover unpleasant facts, and also challenge stories produced by historians sworn to preserve and reproduce the eternal unity of the nation. When I started writing, I did not know how the book would end. University education encourages us to write texts whose final conclusions we know in advance. This is the tried and tested method to avoid contradiction between beginning and end. For the first time here, however, I was on an uncertain and unexpected path. I had grown up and been educated in Israel. When it suddenly appeared to me at an advanced age that the exodus of the children of Israel from Egypt had never taken place, and that the stories in the Bible had no historical basis, the shock I experienced freed my brain from heavy chains I had not been conscious of until then. The way was now clear to question other truths besides the biblical account. Until then, although I never considered myself a Zionist, I knew, like everyone else, that Jews had been exiled in the first century CE and then wandered the world. I had not for a moment questioned this foundational historical event, despite not sharing the belief that this gave the descendants of these exiles 2,000 years later the right to settle in Palestine. If we want to organize the world as it was 2,000 years ago, we will end up with a huge insane asylum. Nor does a religious link to a holy place confer any rights on it. This is true for Zionists today as it was for the Crusaders of yesterday. On this point, I must point out that this position does not lead me to deny the right of the State of Israel to exist. I have said time and again that a child born of rape has the right to live. The fact is there. Refugees from Europe in the wake of the terrible Nazi genocide were forced to join the Zionist enterprise, to emigrate and settle on the land of another population. What has been done cannot be undone without creating a new series of tragedies. We can only repair the injustice as far as possible, provide compensation, and above all, keep in mind in any negotiation the fundamental injustice inflicted on the inhabitants by the newcomers they had not invited. In writing this book, in my great naivete, I set out in search of scholarly work on the exile of the Jewish population from ancient Judea/Palestine. I remember hours spent on this pursuit at the Tel Aviv University Library and on the Internet. As I could not find a single research work on the subject, I approached historians who were specialists in antiquity to ask for their help. Their answer was succinct. There was no book on this subject because the Judeans were not uprooted by force. They simply emigrated and dispersed following the repression of the great revolts. Surprised by this answer, I asked them for a bibliography on the mass emigration. I was told that, given the scarcity of evidence, it was impossible to conduct any research. After the collapse, in my historical consciousness, of the legendary account of the Exodus from Egypt, the turn came for the myth of the exile of the Jewish people. The inhabitants of Judea, being agriculturalists, never abandon their land because peasants do not give up their vital resources unless they are absolutely forced to do so by great poverty and famine. There is no evidence of camps of emigrants and refugees clustered on the borders of Judea at the time, or of Jewish, Aramaic, or Hebrew-speaking colonies on the Mediterranean coast. Unlike the Greeks and the Phoenicians, the inhabitants of Judea were not navigators. Two questions then immediately came to mind. One, where did the many Jewish believers present in Alexandria, Damascus, Rome, Cyprus, Cyrenaica, and other regions and cities of the Mediterranean basin come from? Two, what was the fate of the population left in Judea/Palestine after the destruction of its great temple? A careful reading of ancient Roman literature and Jewish writings soon revealed to me an open secret. From the time of the Hasmoneans, in the 2nd century BCE, Judaism was clearly a proselytizing monotheism that experienced rapid expansion within the Hellenistic world. It was this popularization of Judaism that paved the way for the subsequent arrival of its two younger sisters, Christianity and Islam. Their victory put a stop to conversions to Judaism, which at the same time became a dangerous foreigner whose traces they tried to hide. In the 4th century CE, with the victory of Christianity in the Eastern Roman Empire, the indigenous population of Palestine gradually began to change religion, as evidenced by the appearance of churches in Jerusalem and other sites in Judea and Galilee. However, the gap between the fundamental principles of Judaism and those of Christianity was too wide. The notion of the Son of God upset the rabbis. At the time of the Muslim conquest in the 7th century, however, the majority of the population effectively abandoned their old Jewish beliefs and rallied to the new prophet, who did not claim to be the Son of God, and after all, respected the Old Testament. It seems that there was an additional reason for Islamization. During the first phase of conquest, anyone who embraced the cult of Muhammad was exempt from paying taxes. There was therefore not a population replacement, but a religious replacement. Does this mean that the direct descendants of the ancient children of Israel are the Palestinians? Not exactly. Successive conquerors all left their seed and their seal on the region, and there are no pure populations. Which brings us to the last but not least important question. Is there a Jewish people like the one I learned about at school in Israel? The use of the concept of a people is not particularly scientific, and in fact more adulterated than many others. Nowadays, it has become customary to apply it to a human group sharing such things as an everyday culture, language, songs, or diet. This is how the terms French people, Italian people, or German people are used today, whereas almost everyone knows that there was no French or Italian people 1,000 years ago, and this applies to other peoples too. There were simply empires, kingdoms, principalities, tribes, village peasant communities, and of course, religious communities. Was there, however, a Jewish people before the imaginary act of exile in the 1st century? It is difficult to apply the term people to a largely illiterate population who had no compulsory education, no newspapers or radio, who spoke a different dialect of Hebrew in each region or village. The literate among them in the capital wrote in Aramaic, while their merchants and most of the area's inhabitants spoke Greek. Only religious beliefs and cults benefited from a certain precarious and discontinuous dissemination. Communities of Jewish believers who converted at various historical times have always been the repositories of a rich and fascinating religious culture, but have not shared a culture as a people or a common language. A Jew from Casablanca could not communicate with a Jew from Kiev. They did not like the same food and would have found the other's clothing strange. On the other hand, they could have prayed in the same synagogue, despite differences in the formulation of prayers and liturgical singing. And so, when was the Jewish people, in the modern sense of the word, invented? The answer is simple. In the second half of the 19th century, after the emergence of modern peoples and nations in Western Europe. And if the Socialist Party of the Bund subsequently applied the term people to the large emerging Yiddish population in Eastern Europe, Zionism included Jews from all over the world. Has the invention of the Jewish people been a success? On this point, the answer is more complex. The Yiddish people in Eastern Europe disintegrated under the effects of three historical blows. The pogroms that drove a large population of them westward, mainly to the American continent, the Bolshevik Revolution, which in its degenerative Stalinist phase deliberately erased their culture, and Nazism, which murdered another large part of the Yiddish population. Has Zionism succeeded in unifying the descendants of Jewish believers into a single people and grouping them together to live as one in its nation-state? The answer is no. The majority of emigrants from the Russian Empire did not want to exile themselves to Palestine and sought out other promised lands. Before 1924, when racist laws in the United States curbed Jewish immigration, more than 2 million Yiddish-speaking people came ashore there, while in the same time frame only a few thousand arrived in Palestine. Today, although nowhere in the world is there any obstacle to those with a Jewish identity moving to Israel, the balance of emigration is negative. While Zionism has failed to create a global Jewish people, it has succeeded in building a small Israeli people with its own language and a genuine popular culture. Those across the world who claim to belong to the Jewish people do not speak the language of the Israeli people, do not really know their ways of life, and have no effective share in what they do or suffer. The future of the Israeli people, with whom only a proportion of Jews are willing to identify from a distance, is not theirs. For the reasons I have just outlined, my book has attracted interest both in Israel and in the diaspora. I certainly did not produce new knowledge of historical facts, but I asked new and sometimes difficult questions and tried to provide original answers. Despite the hostility shown to it by Zionist historians, this book has become a bestseller in Israel and been translated into more than 20 languages. Today, however, I feel a certain sense of defeat. I certainly never thought that books could change reality, but it seemed to me in 2008 that I was part of an impressive wave of intellectual resurgence against national imprisonment. I was sure that I was part of an advanced stage in overcoming essentialist identities and crystallizing a greater openness toward the other, the different, and the unknown. I know today that I sinned by excess of optimism. The socio-economic and socio-cultural developments I mentioned earlier have created new walls, reduced expressions of universal solidarity, and pushed masses of people, both West and East, to rally to a defensive political authoritarianism. We have seen the resurrection of pseudo-community, pseudo-religious, and pseudo-ethnic identities, while the hatreds of the past have been dressed in new clothes. Will this trend be reversed? As a historian, I seek to predict the past, not the future. But, having never been fatalistic, I also know that expectations can help guide historical developments. Tel Aviv, June 2019.